Okay. Good morning, everyone, and I would like to thank you for joining us for the ninth lecture, actually, in this series of trade lectures. You know, this is actually a tradition that the Israeli mission started already 2 or perhaps even 3 years ago. So, you know, it's important for me already at the outset to make an important point. We, the mission of Israel, have no hidden agenda, and we don't have any intention to either support or reject any of the views that you will hear today, either from the speaker or from someone else in the room. So I will actually stop here, and I will hand the floor to Rodolfo, who will present our speaker, Professor Manfred Elsing, and Rodolfo will also moderate this meeting. And so again, thank you for your attendance, and I hope that this will be a fruitful and enjoyable lecture for all of us.
Thank you, Yair, for your words. Like Yair mentioned, this is the ninth session, and we clearly see that there's some interest, so we'll keep on doing this. In this session, we're trying something new. Our hope was to stream live, but there were some technical hiccups. Nevertheless, we will be recording the session and uploading it later. We'll provide information on that later. Just so that you're aware, we will not be recording the Q&A portion of the session. It's just the lecture, so you can speak freely. Now, as to the topic, is WTO reform feasible? Lessons from political science research. There is a lot of talk currently in the WTO as well as in other international organizations. Many of these organizations have been in place for many years, and even though they continue to work, it's undeniable that the world is changing and this demands some changes. But how this can be done is the topic of this lecture. For these topics, we couldn't find a better speaker than Professor Manfred Elsig. He has both an academic academic background that supports this, as well as a practical support behind it. So I think that this will be very useful. Just briefly, Professor Elsig is Professor of International Relations and Deputy Managing Director at the World Trade Institute of Bern. He has studied in University of Bern, Bordeaux, and he has worked at the practical experience, like just to mention one, at the Swiss Federal Office for Foreign Economic Affairs, and he holds a PhD from the University of Zurich. He has taught in the University of Geneva, the Grother Institute, the London School of Economics, and the Thunderbird School of Global Management. And his courses include International Political Economy, International Relations Theories, International Institutions, Globalization, and European Integration and Research Methods. So as you can see, he's pretty knowledgeable on this topic. So Professor Elsig, welcome.
All right, so good morning, everyone. Thank you to the Embassy of Israel to inviting me to this to the talk here. I was asked a couple of months ago what I would like to talk about, and I wasn't really sure, so I thought, we should be thinking a little bit more about reform. I assume that's an important theme in Geneva at the World Trade Organization currently. And I was also thinking maybe can we shed some light on this question of reform, focusing on political science research. Now, maybe as a caveat to start with, I won't be able to tell you today, on the one hand, the likelihood or propensity of reform, A, and B, what type of reform. So I won't be able to do that. The idea is really, I think, to draw your attention to, I would say, other fields, other disciplines such as political science, and see what can they maybe help us or not teach us about sort of the likelihood of reform of organizations such as the World Trade Organization. So what is sort of my motivation for this talk? As mentioned, I think reforming IOs, so not just the World Trade Organization, but also reforming the World Trade Organization is quite an important topic. I don't recall that we've had this so often happening in the past 20 years. So I think it's sort of also a window of opportunity for us to think and talk about reform. I think we've seen a lot of suggestions and ideas, particularly related to dispute settlement, the apple of body, a lot of details, technical nature and legal nature. I've not heard a lot of ideas from political science and national relations, so I thought let's discuss this, let's talk about this. What could be here broader concepts or theories from political science, international relations research that could be helpful for thinking about reform? And also, can we learn lessons, if any, from past research on the WTO, on the GATT, on reform? Thinking about sort of what are the conditions under which reform has been happening? And are those conditions today the same as in the past, or what has changed? And then finally, also for me as an academic, learning from you, because there's a lot of wisdom and knowledge in this room, and it's important for us researchers also to get direct feedback and inputs from those who are actually negotiating here on a daily basis and thinking probably even more than I think about reforming the system. So this is these are some of the thinking motivations for the talk. This is sort of the plan for the next 40 minutes or so, what I'd like to talk about. First, I'd like to remind those of you who might have not been studying international relations theory that there's three grand schools out there, realism, liberalism, and social constructivism, and they all have different things to say about international organizations design, international organizations reform. So I will present these very briefly. Then I'll talk about WTO reform, and here asking the question, well, what does reform mean? Reforming what? Then I look back a little bit at historical records of WTO reform, particularly thinking about institutional reform. This would be a very short discussion. There hasn't been that much. Then I'd like to present some of my own research that has focused on one of the, I would say, most important institutional reforms in the past, namely the agreement on the DSU, and looking at sort of what have been basically the factors that led to the creation of what we call a legalization leap, a delegation to a quasi-international trade court. Then I'll talk a little bit about the problems of that success. Or some scholars have already 15 years ago asked the question, has legalization gone too far? And then I will proceed to a short comparison between sort of the Uruguay round context and today's context, which will basically will be about sort of the differences we have in the context today. And then I end with a couple of reflections, maybe sort of scenarios. Depending on the scenarios, what could we observe, what could we expect to be happening down the road. But that's the plan for this morning. So let's talk first about the three perspectives, or we call them also the grand schools of international relations theories. So realism, which is all about power, power relations, power explaining basically outcomes, both in international cooperation and design of international institutions, reform of international institutions. Then functional liberal explanations that are focusing on the interests of states in particular. What are the interests of states to create international organizations? What are interests of states regarding the reform of international organizations? And then the third school, social constructivism, which looks at shared norms, shared ideas that basically affect the international cooperation. And I'm picking out here maybe a couple of of past research contributions, maybe to give you an idea what the argument has been. Let's start out with power and power-based perspectives. A realist contribution, a very influential one, has been by Lloyd Gruber in a book he wrote 20 years ago, where he coined the term go-it-alone power. And basically he was looking at the Uruguay round negotiations, and his argument was, at that time, the US and the European communities together had a go-it-alone power, which means they could set basically the agenda, they could agree jointly on what had to be changed, and then they basically presented this to the rest of the membership. And maybe the more experienced trade experts in the room certainly recall that the idea came up of creating the World Trade Organization. At the same time, the signal was sent out to the membership that the old GATT rules would no longer apply, the agreements would not longer apply. So basically, either you join this new WTO with all its agreements, or you don't. And if you don't join, then that probably sends a message to the investors out there, and that would be probably not good for your economy. So basically, they were setting jointly the rules, and that's a realist kind of argument, and others had to join this. There was not much choice at the time. So that's sort of an example of a power-based argument about the creation of the World Trade Organization. A huge change of institutional reforms here. Interest-based perspective, or like a functional argument, usually starts with trying to figure out whether states have overlap of interests. You have a majority of states that have an interest in cooperation, so they see positive gains from cooperation. They see, for instance, an advantage of reciprocity. If I open up my markets, the other side open up markets, and that's on the aggregate beneficial to all the parties to this agreement. This another aspect, maybe from an interest-based approach, is thinking about context. So what is the context in which negotiations take place? And here I draw your attention to more recent work by Kopelevich and Putnam, who basically argue in order to understand international institutions reform, we need to understand the context in which they take place. And the context, if context, they mean, for instance, the experience of past cooperation. They look at a range of international institutions and say, you know, the better sort of the optimistic or positive past cooperation has been, the more likely we see certain types of institutional reform happening. So liberalists and functionalists draw attention to the question, well, first of all, is there overlap of interests in cooperation? And what could drive, basically, the design choices? And that's mainly driven by past experience. Third and last school of thought, social constructivist or norm-based ideas, I have put down two sort of, I would say, buzzwords here you would find in that literature. One, the work by John Eikenberry, who has been talking about constitutional moments. He's seen reform of the international system, of international organizations, in times which he called where we had constitutional moments. So after the end of the Second World War, around the time of the end of the Cold War. This opened up opportunities for cooperation. There was a shared understanding of states, of governments. There was a consensus to move forward in building, based on liberal norms, a system of cooperation. Or the work by Finnemore and Sicking, social constructivists, who talk about shared norms, the norm emergence. Do we see enough shared norms for states? Let's call this, for instance, a norm of gradual liberalization, of reciprocity. If states buy into this norm, this is very powerful and it can help bring about change. So depending on, I think, as a researcher, what kind of normative frame you are having in mind, you look at different factors. The realists look at power. Everything is power politics. The liberals, functionalists look at interest. Do we find interest for cooperation? And the social constructivists look for sort of emerging norms, ideas that can be influential for change. So these are, I think, just as a starting point, the three different schools. And of course, when one thinks about reform, question is always, what kind of school do I have in mind when I come up with some of those ideas? The second point is the question of the meaning of reform. And I'm not, when I was preparing for this talk, I was again thinking about what does reform actually mean? And I realized reform means for many people different things. And if I, which I haven't done in detail, look at some of the reform proposals of WTO members, you see in these proposals often a mix of different reforms, some which are about what I would call commitments, and some which are about sort of institutional design or institutional processes. And I think for the sake of discussion, I think it's also important to distinguish different types of reforms, whether it's institutional reform or if it's about creating additional or different commitments. Also, I think we see reform proposals across the different areas of or the functions of the organization, be it in the area of decision making, which you could say that's the legislative part, in the area of dispute settlement, which would be sort of the judicial function of the organization, and the executive function, which is the regime management. We see different proposals in different of dysfunctional areas. And one could also differentiate between grand reform ideas. I think, again, the Uruguay Round negotiations and what came out of it could be seen as a grand reform and incremental reform. And of course, what we see mostly in international institutions, most of the reforms are incremental by nature. It's hard to find really these grand reform events that take place. So a lot is incremental over time. And in that respect, also, I think it's good to think about incremental reforms and reforms in terms of changing formal institutions and changing informal institutions. Now, I would probably argue a very important informal institution in this house is consensus, the consensus principle. That's an informal institution for me. Formal institutions would be about voting and procedures. And I think here we also see often that maybe something is in the books, in the law, but actually what happens on the ground, the actual day-to-day work, is maybe often also influenced by informal institutions. Next point maybe to raise is, can we learn from the past? And I mentioned at the beginning, if you look at classical institutional reforms, formal institutional reforms, we will find few cases. If you look at the history of the gut and the different areas, you see a lot of instances of incremental reform, but often beyond some institutional reform. Let's take maybe the area of negotiations, right? We see a lot of, I would say also, sometimes informal institutions, or more or less formalized institutions. Some of you might recall the so-called consultative group of 18, which played a role in the 1970s, 80s. If we look at how negotiations take place in the GATT and then in the WTO, we see a lot of informal groups. We see coalitions, the green room. Most of this, I would say, is largely informal. I have myself worked on an interesting question, I thought, was what was the role of the secretariat in the negotiations over time, looking at the different trade rounds? And for instance, what I found in that research is the role of the WTO secretariat decreased over time in the negotiations. So give example, if you look at the Tokyo round, if you look at the Kennedy round, and even later, we see examples where secretariat officials were asked to chair negotiation groups. Now, if you chair negotiation groups, you have more influence than if you're not chairing negotiation groups, right? And there's some work I did on this to understand why this changed. And these are informal changes. You could say the system reformed in a way. It changed. It was incremental. So when we look around at the universe of sort of potential reform cases, I think one stands out, and that's the dispute settlement understanding. This is an area where I think which could be served, could serve as a test case. Do we understand how the DSU came about? And will this provide us with any lessons for 2019? So I'll talk a little bit about that research to maybe give you an idea of what some of those findings are which we came across. We looked at basically how negotiations in the Uruguay round in relation to the negotiation group that was taking care of the dispute settlement understanding, how those negotiations proceeded. So what kind of interests different actors had, different states had, what maybe also affected this outcome. And the outcome is something we called sort of a puzzle, a surprise, and I think it came as a surprise for most negotiators who were basically in Geneva from the very beginning. The 1982, when the question was tackled, so how, what are we going to reform? One of the reform projects was dispute settlement. There was agreement that the system had to be fixed, but there was no clear understanding in which way this reform would be going. So it came out in the end as a surprise, this highly legalized system with the appellate body as basically an appeal instance that was added and all the different changes. If you look at the literature, when we were looking at the literature at the time when we were working on this, we found that there was a realist argument out there, very prominent. The realist argument was the rules of that were negotiated during the Uruguay round negotiations reflected U.S. interests. So the U.S. had also no problem supporting a highly legalized dispute settlement system, because that would back up basically the rules which were in favor of the U.S. That was the realist argument that was out there. There was actually an interesting liberal argument that had some traction at the time, and the argument was the U.S. was in favor of the dispute settlement understanding the way it was negotiated because they tried, USTR tried to bind Congress hands. It was quite a prominent explanation. Now, we looked at that in more detail. We didn't really find much evidence in the end for this tying hands argument. But we actually, looking at the entire negotiation history, came up with our own argument, which we thought would complement the research on the dispute settlement understanding. And what we found, which was key for the outcomes we observed, was sort of what we call an interaction effect. So basically two very important factors came together at the time, which led to this very important change, institutional change. One was, and we can actually think about this nowadays, the negotiation group that was taking care of dispute settlement understanding, in this negotiation group, one could say what dominated was a cooperative form of bargaining, a value-creating environment. So it was an environment where the negotiators tried to come up with solutions that would help, basically, kind of taking account of all the different interests in the room. So that's one thing which we observed. These negotiations actually were not the key negotiations at the beginning. The negotiators were more interested in sort of the commitments, anti-dumping, for instance, or trips or services, what have you, but not so much dispute settlement. Their interest only at the end of the negotiations turned to that topic. And second, also, we actually have seen that going into these negotiations, the European communities, they did not want to have a reform of the dispute settlement system. But over time, the EU position or the EC position changed. And we see a convergence of US and EU positions, which we see as a necessary condition, of course, for a successful outcome. So we see both. We see sort of a convergence of interest of the US and EU at the time, EC, and we see basically that it has been a negotiation environment that allowed for value-creating proposals. Just maybe to give you a bit more of the findings of this two studies we did on this, which explains this surprising outcome. Of course, one of the assumptions starting this project was we assumed that the US and the EC at the time need to agree. We see basically going back that the GATT period was characterized by an anti-legal attitude mainly. Over time, we saw gradual change, incremental change, increased legalizations. But we know from the that time the countries could easily block the process. When the Uruguay round started, there was sort of agreement. Yes, let's fix the system. The system doesn't work. But we had no real reform proposals at the very beginning. It was like, let's start the process. Let's start negotiating and see what basically comes out. How can we fix the system? Now, you're aware and familiar with the changes that came out of these negotiations. I put down four, which I would see as radical changes. Right to a panel, the automaticity of the findings, the creation of the appellate body, and also various agreements that strengthened the implementation side of this. So all this was not thinkable in 1982 when sort of the process started in 1985, 86, when really the negotiations started to kick in. So going back to our argument, what we see through talking to the negotiators at the time who were all involved in these negotiations, through these interviews, we realized that we saw that there was a certain autonomy in this group of negotiations. They all had discretion from their own capitals. They didn't have a tight mandate. They had the discretion-based mandate from their own countries. And that created a necessary environment to build trust and promote this value-creating integrative negotiation tactics, which allowed to basically move forward in the negotiations. And it was, as I mentioned, quite a lot delinked from highly salient issues in the negotiations. And that was probably an advantage at the time. And in terms of this convergence of interests of the US and the EU, I mean, what we've seen there is that the EU has engaged in something which we called experiential learning. It's like the context. The EU, or the EC at the time, was still involved in a number of GATT cases. And basically, over time, they got better in these cases, meaning they won more cases, they got more expertise. They put more emphasis on this. They brought more legal experts to Geneva. And over time, the European community has changed its attitude towards dispute settlement. So it actually is the actor that shifted quite a lot its position over 5 years, 6 years period. So what we've seen is this periodically updating of information by the negotiators about sort of the distributional consequences of these disputes. Of course, the moment you start winning disputes, you have a different view on the system than when you constantly lose those kind of disputes. And I can talk about this more in the Q&As if you have more questions on this. So we've seen this empirics is really the US has some issues going into the negotiations with blocked cases, but they've been generally positive, I would say. It's not that the U.S. saw a huge urgency for change. They wanted to address certain multiple veto points in the process that would certainly benefit the U.S. in dispute settlement. As mentioned, the EC started out to be very reluctant to engage in any reform of the dispute settlement system. And there was a lack of legal culture and critical stance towards dispute settlement at the time. And then we see really over time, and again, negotiations take time, we see over time how their views on legalization converged. So delegating basically to third-party arbitration, if you want, and creating a more legalized process. The U.S., on the one hand, got more and more frustrated during the negotiations about sort of the lack of adoption of those reports. Or they saw also a lot of panel reports to be inadequate. And they were pushing more and more for legalization. The EC, again, over time, started to become more proactive. And in the end of the negotiation, actually, the EC was the champion of the appellate body. At the very beginning, they were opposed to any legalization happening.
And we look into this paper. In this papers, we show how the experience with actual cases led to a change of interests and preferences on the EC side. And I don't want to go in details here, but I think one interesting case at the time was the oilseed case. It was a non-violation complaint case, and basically the feedback in Brussels was that the EC was performing poorly. In sort of arguing the case, and something had to be done about this. And then basically Brussels sent more legal experts, both in the negotiation groups. That was Peter Jan Kuiper at the time, who was sent as part of a legal expert, so it actually wasn't in this negotiation group before. And also on the cases, the EC started to be successful, started to win cases. And so they started to shift actually their view on sort of the legalization story. So what are the lessons learned of this type of research where we looked at sort of one success, or the most important, I would say, institutional reform case in the WTO, got WTO history. So again, I think it's sort of also supporting, I guess, a bit more the liberal functional view that basically when states and governments negotiate, in this case, judicial procedures or institutions, they look at their own experience with the current rules. So they think of, if we change the rules, how is the status quo for us at the moment? How well is the system functioning for us? And if we change things, in which direction should they go? So it's very much basically the status quo of the situation very much determines the position and the reading of the status quo in the negotiations. The studies also show this convergence of preferences, which are held by trust among negotiators. And certainly that these negotiations were taking place outside the big headlines, the big politicized issues during the GATT negotiations. What were additional supporting factors we found? Certainly is, yes, we are in the late 1980s, the end of the Cold War. We see there is sort of a constitutional moment around that time, which helped basically, I would say, put this negotiations over the finish line. That helped quite a bit. And the single package approach certainly also helped. So there were cross linkages, there were cross concessions. That certainly at the time helped also to bring about this institutional reform. So this case I suggest, I would say one way or one causal way of how reform, in this case legalization, can happen. It doesn't have to be the only case. You can think of different sort of causal mechanism, causal sort of relations between sort of starting a process and then coming up with an institutional reform. And in this case, we looked at something which has been about delegation, right? When we talk about reform today, there's also, of course, talk about less delegation, right? There's also talk about reform in a very different direction. And if you think about that, then maybe also the conditions and the factors might be a bit different. So let's maybe fast forward now from the good old times, from the Uruguay round negotiations, and thinking about the conditions under which reform at the time was possible, was feasible. So where are we today? One thing I already mentioned a little bit at the beginning, some have argued for a long time there's an imbalance between the rulemaking arm and sort of the whole dispute settlement side of the organization. And scholars like Goldstein and Martin already in 2000 were quite critical. They wrote a critical note on the WTO dispute settlement system and asked the question, maybe legalization has gone too far. And at that time, their argument was, well, it would become more difficult in the future to agree among a growing number of members on new rules that now, given this new dispute settlement system, can be credibly enforced. So it's not some cheap talk. You just sign some international agreement and there's no enforcement there. There is an enforcement system with teeth. And that could hinder the progress in the negotiations. And more veto players at home, interest groups at home, discover the WTO, and there's a lot of actors that will block the process, and that will also hinder members and governments to put forward value-creating proposals. And of course, also legalization and how the appellate body and the panels and so on, all the cases have unfolded over time, has certainly also led to something which others have called an eye of the beholder problem. Huh? If you win a lot of cases, you like the system. If you lose a lot of cases, you don't like the system, right? To put it very bluntly. And we've seen the increasing U.S. concern, going back to also the administrations run by Democratic presidents or from the Democratic Party. And we've seen an increasing politicization and criticism of the U.S. But then also, I would say, this is one story. So the dispute settlement today is not something that is kind of hidden as it used to be. It's highly politicized. So any reform here will probably bring about a lot of alarm bells ring at the same time. On the other side, I think we have a lot of contextual factors that have changed since the 1980s. And I think that's also why the comparison from past research is not easy. It weakens the case of saying, okay, what are the lessons learned from past research? Can we apply this to 2019? And here are some of those additional, I would say, contextual factors or factors that have changed, which I would argue have to be taken into account when we think about reform. The one briefly mentioned is we had the single undertaking at the time, and that certainly helped also then to come to a conclusion. There were package deals across different areas. We do no longer work with this kind of concept in decision making, right? And I actually came up with this triangle probably more than 10 years ago. I said, look, I think when you think about decision making at WTO, we can make the argument that there are three important pillars, at least 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that are sort of in place. One is the single undertaking, which was invented during the Uruguay round negotiations, didn't exist before. We have this idea of a member-driven organization. More and more, I think the secretariat has been pushed back into the background in the negotiations. And we have this consensus decision-making principle. And we were making the case that at the time that we think it's incompatible in the sense that you can't have all three for a system to function. So you got to choose which two you're going to go for. And basically, I think now we can say with the empirical observation here, the members have given up single undertaking for quite some time now. So basically, we still have a system which is member-driven, which is consensus principle. But the idea is really that the members try to find solutions through, for instance, plurilateral processes, plurilateral agreements, trying to tackle issue by issue area instead of trying to create a single undertaking. But certainly that has taken away something, I think, which has been important for reform in the past, this kind of possibility for package deals that is in some sense gone. The second one, I think, is the overall cooperation problem that is being tackled in the WTO. And many of the gold gutheads and experts would tell you, yes, at the times when we were looking at tariffs, that was, yes, it was difficult, but there was a way we could find solutions, right? You would say, I lower my tariffs on X and Y, and in exchange, you lower your tariffs on other products. So there was sort of this reciprocity in trying to eliminate barriers to trade. So that's also called in political science research negative integration. You're trying to basically lower barriers to trade. Now, for a number of years now, we've realized that the topics we're facing have more sort of the characteristics of positive integration, meaning you're working on trying to find rules that are applicable to a large group of countries. So you're trying to find rules that work for all. And I've just, in this figure, I've put down some information on non-tariff measures. And I think in non-tariff measures, you see a lot of areas where we face this challenge of positive integration, finding rules, agreement on rules that work for everyone. So, intellectual property rights is actually an interesting one, certainly to be to be mentioned or SBS, all the standards, investment, etc. So that is also different from the old times when I think the attention of that time was on the tariff side. And we see this also in bilateral and preferential trade agreements, that basically the work on the tariff side is often less difficult than the work which is on positive integration, regulatory cooperation, things like that. So basically that has also changed on the commitment side. I think that makes it not easier. The PTAs I mentioned, preferential trade agreements, when we think back at the Uruguay round negotiations, there were few bilateral or preferential trade agreements in place. The US was negotiating in parallel US-Canada and then NAFTA. The EC wasn't really negotiating until the 1990s its trade agreements. So we have basically different outside options, and we see how members use those type of outside options today. So instead of maybe investing into reform, they're saying, okay, let's try to get things changed in other fora. So different types of forum or venue shopping that is happening much more often today than in the past. What has also changed? I probably have to talk about China as well, right? So when you think back about the 1980s, we talked about the G2, European communities, the US. They need to agree on a deal. And that was the recipe for success. It was easier then to multilateralize those kind of bilateral deals. Now we have, of course, moved in the last 20 years in something people call the multipolar trade world. We have a lot of emerging economies, in particular China. So we actually moved back from a system where you had to find core agreements among two actors into a system where you have to have more actors around the table agreeing on the key issues. So that doesn't make it easier for thinking about solutions, thinking about reforming the system. And then there's something that I think kicked in the last 2 years very strongly, and I would call this that sort of a liberal norm consensus that we thought was out there, which was pushed very much by the US, has been eroded. This liberal norm, and I think in all the discussions we have been witnessing about trade deficits, I think we see that happening basically, right? This consensus about the role of the WTO, the role of liberalization, of liberal norms that the organization stands for, has been questioned. And it has been questioned by one of the creators, if not the key creator of the system, right? So here I think that's something that came, I guess, as a surprise for many of us. And I don't want to analyze this tweet by Donald Trump. There's always a lot in one tweet. Just look at the last sentence. The WTO is unfair to the US, right? So, I mean, if the big sort of supporter and the leader of the hegemon of the system says the system is unfair, then you know the system is in trouble. So I've talked a lot about things that are different now, right? Things that changed, the context changed, actor support changed. I mean, is there something similar? Thinking about that, and I thought, well, there is something which has been similar in the 1980s, and I have actually not talked so much about that, but during the Reagan administration, the U.S. was actually quite trying to push unilateral policies against some of its major competitors at the time, which were Japan and Germany. And the Omnibus Trade Act, 1988, is certainly one incident. But also think about something which we don't hear much today, but now if Trump comes back, is the voluntary export restraints, the VERs. So you see unilateral measures and policies that were in place at the time. And I think today this new sort of protectionism we see, that is something that also changes the status quo, and it puts pressure on other members as well. So in some sense, I think that we're here and just discussing reform, I think is also a result, of course, of unilateral pressures, right? So in some sense, one could also say, well, it's a certain window of opportunity that we are having today, right? So there is change of status quo, and now question is, how are we going to react? So, is WTO reform feasible? And I told you at the very beginning, I don't know that answer, right? And I can't give you any numbers on the likelihood and which direction it goes. But I would like to use the last couple of minutes of my talk to think in terms of scenarios, right? So what kind of scenarios can we or are we observing or could we observe? Now, let's start out with the power realist view, right? So a realist would probably argue, well, the U.S. wants to rebalance sort of the organization that it reflects better its interests. Huh? And we could look at some of the proposals on the table the U.S. has been putting forward, which probably reflect these concerns. These concerns, whether, I'm not now saying whether these concerns are real or not real, but they are on the table, right? These are things they would like to see changed. And if those things from that scenario are addressed in a certain way, one could think then that the U.S. might be able to talk about deblocking the dispute settlement impasse we have. Otherwise, and I think it has been also quite clear about that, it prefers sort of the more old gut type of dispute settlement. In this kind of scenario, I think what we see from a realist perspective is that the EU and Japan are kind of seen as junior partners. So a little bit of a pressure on them to work with the US in that direction. The question in that scenario, of course, is how does China react? To what degree will it accommodate these concerns raised by the US? And we all are observing that basically the action went to the bilateral arena, so bilateral talks. To what degree we will see here some outcomes that suggest more accommodation from the Chinese leadership or a balancing, in some sense, trying to actually push an alternative way in terms of trying to sort of not give in on those issues and putting on other concerns on the table. So that could be sort of like a realist scenario that's kind of could be unfolding. Let's turn to sort of a functional liberal view or scenario, right? So what would maybe liberal scholars, functional scholars, think about, or where would they find sort of examples where they see a liberal scenario unfolding? I think one of the sort of past research writings that many people have cited recently is the work by Duncan Snydel. And Duncan Snydel in 1985, basically when there was a very influential book in the field of international relations called After Hegemony, which suggested the U.S. was in decline in the 1980s and what's going to happen now. Very similar discussion we kind of observed today. Duncan Snydel talked about, for instance, the gut and said, well, even if someone loses the interest in a system, if a large group of the members continue to believe in the benefits of the system, they can continue using the system without the leader, without the hegemon. As long as reciprocity for the remaining members of the institution remain very important, as long as they see joint benefits that can be created through continuing to work through the system, then that could work. And I think we observe also attempts, so we observe behavior of states that suggest there is a group of countries that believes in the system to be in its interest, continued interest, and we see more incremental reform proposals, incremental processes that suggest that there could be some movement. So think about the plurilaterals that are re-energized. Or think about the recent, I think it was a decision of two parties to the panel who said, well, we might not then use the apple body under this and this conditions. Right? So as long as members have a continued interest, they might continue to support the system and it survives. And that's been the basic argument of Duncan Snydel. It can even survive without the leader, as long as there's sufficient interest of all of a large group of members that it's in their joint interest. The third final scenario is sort of like sort of a norm-based social constructivist scenario, right? So what will maybe social constructivists, and they come to Geneva, what would they observe? What would they say? What see what's happening? And they will be looking out for maybe a new or adapted Geneva-based consensus. They'll be focusing on epistemic communities, which are basically members, which are academics, which are experts. Are they actually converging somehow in creating a new norm that guides the behavior? And how would that norm look like? Of course, I think the bad news from a social constructivist perspective, there's a lot of norm competition going on. You might see on the one hand sort of a norm, we could call this economic nationalism, right, which guides the behavior of some states, in particular one state. And there might be, of course, another norm, already existing norm, about supporting a rules-based system, rules-based liberalization, upholding multilateralism. So we have a norm competition. And as long as this norm competition is ongoing, there's no convergence on this, then norms don't really have a lot of influence on reform. So basically, I think it's a very high threshold here to see and observe a new norm that might be developing. Particularly, it takes a lot of time for norms to emerge. So let me maybe come close to the conclusions of all this. What can we make out of all of this from international relations research and thinking about scenarios? I think we see different scenarios unfolding. Right? I think there is sort of a case to be made. There are sort of developments that could be interpreted and understood from a realist perspective. There are developments that could be understood and interpreted from a more functional and liberal perspective. The power scenario is probably the moment I would say the most visible. Question, of course, when I think about scenarios and long term is, well, will the US elections 2020 change this? That's maybe more for discussion. I think a liberal scenario gets some traction. I think I made that case already. I think there is a bit of a rediscovery of a number of members for preserving this collective good that the organization provides. And it's basically testing within existing boundaries without really institutional reform how much the system can be preserved. The norm scenario, I think, is a long shot, and norm competition is going on. Also, I think we can say, looking at sort of what's out there at the moment in terms of the reform proposals and the discussions, I think mostly it's about subjects. And many of these are very tricky subjects. And it's about maybe also adjusting informal practices. But all this takes time. Institutional reform is a very long game. So I think from today looking ahead, I mean, that will take years. But the question I have a little bit, or maybe also starting with a positive note of all of this, I think given the high politicization and sort of the different proposals on the table of reform, but the difficulties for coming to some consensus on reform, is that maybe some of the other work that has been going on for years now is moving a bit away from the high sort of the high visibility, and could potentially undergo some progress. So thinking about examples, e-commerce, environmental goods agreements, and these kind of things, which are no longer from the outside in the high headlines, and maybe there is, for those who want to push forward these kind of negotiations, they can maybe make some progress. Good. I think that's all I wanted to basically say, I wanted to present, and I hope I have, and I'm sure I've probably provoked a number of you in the room, and so I'm actually very much looking forward to your comments, questions, contestations, and maybe your ideas about reform and how feasible is. In that sense, I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Manfred, for that comprehensive overview. I think that the case study the DSU highlights some very important issues that can be useful for our discussions at the moment, even with some of the changes in the context. With this, we'll open the floor for some questions, but before we do that, just get the conversation started with a couple of questions. In your presentation, you mentioned a bit about the role that was taken by the by the delegates here in Geneva, as well as the influence or more active participation of the Secretariat under, this is important for us because we're here in Geneva and we're seeing what we can do here because it seems that the conversation has shifted a bit more to capital base. So if you can address this about what are the practical issues or if this is something that we can do here in Geneva. The other issue that I wanted to hear your comments, in your presentation you hinted at some of the new changes in the context, and I'm thinking specifically about social media. A lot of the discussions in the past took place without the public. There were affairs of the public. Now there's a bit more of transparency, but with that also comes a bit of misinformation. So what can be done, what can we do to foster like a positive discussion in these other areas that are influential in what goes on here, but are not in our direct control? So, I mean, just those two, and then we'll open the discussion.
Well, thanks for this question. So maybe I take first the second one, and it's actually something I thought about talking about as well. I then left it out. It's the context in some sense that in the 1980s the negotiations took place behind closed doors. The wider public in the 1980s didn't even know what the God was. That all started way later with the whole, I'd say, anti-globalization movement kicking in the 1990s. And so I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we also have a different kind of environment with some call it the democratization of news, but it's sort of the social media. And with it, of course, also the negative effects, such as you mentioned, misinformation. Now, I think from my observation, a lot of this is happening in domestic politics. I mean, this misinformation. I don't really think that on let's say, think about the Geneva and the World Trade Organization. I would say there's not so much asymmetry of information within the WTO and all the members who are active here. I think it's pretty clear for everyone who has what kind of interests, what kind of preferences. I think the information is quite high, I would say, very little information asymmetry. So when we think about false information, that's really about domestic politics, and it's about the way maybe some of the politicians portray the WTO to its own constituencies. And yes, the WTO has become more important as an institution for many, many, I think, discussions in various WTO members. You know, for instance, now the whole discussion in Britain about the WTO, right? I mean, that's one way of thinking about the WTO. And there's also a false information in that respect. But we certainly have also the instrumentalization on the other side and all the bad things that would come out of the international organizations. And if you think back about the tweet I showed, about Trump tweeting about how unfair the WTO was, right? So we have then really politicians at the helmet in power who basically spread this type of news. And I think that's certainly not helpful if you think in terms of maybe getting support from certain interest groups and civil society actors. But I still think, I mean, in Geneva, the information is so high quality as well. People know what they're talking about. They know exactly what the problems are, that it's more a question then of do we get the overlap of interests and the will of people. But you're absolutely right. I think the whole kind of information environment has changed dramatically as well. The second point about the delegates in Geneva and more active participation. Now, I just mentioned that as an example, I think, which when you go back and you look at the negotiations, you see that there's two things that have changed. One is the secretariat officials are less involved in the negotiations directly. I'm not saying indirectly through consulting and through expertise, but they were no longer asked to chair negotiation groups starting in the Uruguay round negotiations around. So if you go back really into Tokyo round and you look at the minutes there, you talk to some of the older gentlemen who were working at the time, the secretariat officials had probably more agenda-setting power because they were chairing the negotiations. And that helped in particularly for one important issue, and that's called the cycling problem. Sometimes you need a more independent actor if you have different proposals on the table to push things forward. Now this has changed. I think that we are in a situation that we are in. The members are more influential, there are more members, the organization has grown. And I think the question here really is, it's not an institutional reform question, or is there a way, and I've been arguing that for a while, that the expertise of the secretariat, its institutional memory, etc., could be used more. So maybe these two responses to your questions.
Thank you. So now I'll open the floor to some questions. Does anyone have any questions? If that's not the case, I'll just, you did answer the question regarding the secretariat, but I'm also interested about the role here in Geneva. You said that the delegates had some leeway to set the discussion and, and build some trust with the discussion here. It seems that it's less the case now. It's being more directly between capitals, and specifically some capitals, not all of them. So is there a role for the Geneva-based delegates in this in this reform?
Well, I'm not sure I have an answer for that question, which is an interesting question. I think over time, and you're rightly, one probably observes that also the leeway, autonomy of Geneva-based officials in many cases might have gone back, is probably less. And that has to do, as you mentioned, with a lot of contextual factors. The one you raised before, information, right? I mean, if you go back in the old times, and we don't have the old times anymore, but, you know, if you negotiate behind back doors, there were much more also side deals you could do. You could build much more trust. Things didn't get leaked to the press as quickly. That all of this, I think, has certainly had an impact on the role of a negotiator in Geneva. But then it's the overall, I think, politicization and trade. I mean, again, in the 1980s, the negotiators were I think, trying, and they were successfully in creating a new organization, new agreements, extending the trade portfolio, dispute settlement. And at the time, I think few were thinking about distributional effects of this. And the more capitals have realized the distributional effects, both on the rulemaking, on this positive integration I was talking about, finding sort of rules, agreeing on rules, and all the distributional effects of this, plus the distributional effects of a dispute settlement system. That has certainly led to, I think, the capitals being more attentive to what's happening. So in some sense, I would say yes, I think the leeway for both the secretariat officials, but also the members, has shrunk. Now, I don't have a solution or no institutional reform solution for this. I think it's a fact, right? And the question is, how can you bring about changes and reforms in this new context, which means more players, more veto players in the end of the day? Can we go back to these old times where you were able to, over dinner, make a deal and then convince other members and then convince the capitals about this, about also that's in their interest, right? I think that has changed. And I completely agree with your assessment there.
I want to thank for your insight and sharing your expertise. And thank you all for participating in this lecture. We hope that you can attend the future ones. And I don't want to stand in between you and your lunch. So thank you very much. Thank you, Professor.